Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy. I've got Nir Eyal with me. Nir, do you remember the question you asked me before we started? No, you don't. You're saying, why do you even want to talk about ad nectar?
Yes. Why do you want to talk about ad nectar?
Here's why. I think like a lot of our friends, a lot of my friends, I read your book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. And I thought, boy, this guy knows his stuff. You know, he's not just a guy who did a book report and then is now selling it to us like a book. He's a guy who really knows it. He has experience. And so, like a lot of other people, I flipped to the back of the book where it says about the authors. And there's a note here about Ryan Hoover. Interesting. Who is your co-author. And a note about you. And it says, Nir Eyal writes, consults, and teaches about the intersection of psychology, et cetera, et cetera. It goes, he's an advisor, et cetera, et cetera. His most recent startup received venture funding from Kleiner Perkins, but doesn't include the name of the startup. It says you created two different startups before. Doesn't even include the name of the companies.
Yeah.
You don't talk much about what you did. And I feel that that's important for knowing where this guy came from, whose book we're all reading.
Right. Well, I do talk about the companies in the book.
I did a search within the Kindle book for Ad Nectar. I couldn't come up with the name.
Well, I do talk about my experience in the advertising and gaming industry, which is what Ad Nectar did. But it's kind of like, you know, for the book is written for a mainstream audience. And so I you know, unless you're Google or Facebook or Twitter and you're a household name, who gives a shit what the name of your company was? It's more important, I think, what I did. And so
really,
that's,
you really believe that it doesn't matter what company you started? Doesn't matter this experience, this accomplishment that you've had?
Well, to be totally transparent, it wasn't the best outcome. We didn't go IPO. We raised money and we had a semi-successful exit, but it wasn't, frankly, the proudest period in my life because I'll tell you exactly why. I didn't do the business for the right reasons. I started that company for one reason and one reason only, which was to try and have a big outcome. And the biggest lesson from that business was that I'll never do that again. I will not start a business just because I think there's a financial opportunity.
You were sitting around and saying, where's the most money?
Yeah, twice, okay. In fact. The business I started before that, Sunshine, was also. I liked the business. It was interesting. And I saw, but mostly I saw an opportunity. And that's, I think that's a rookie mistake. And I'm glad I made the mistake with the least possible carnage. You know, one thing that I'm very proud of is that everybody I've ever done business with in those two businesses, I still call friends, including my co-founders. And, you know, a lot of times when a business doesn't have a fantastic outcome, and we did okay. I mean, we kind of had a soft landing and acqui-hire situation on Ad Nectar. Sunshine was a different story. Sunshine, for my very first company, I would call a success. The second company, Ad Nectar, you know, wasn't all that great. And I'm still, you know, I see my co-founders probably twice, three times a month. We're still very good friends. And that's something that, you know, was a huge risk of starting a company with your friends.
You guys were at Ad Nectar. You were Stanford graduate business school students. It was you. It was Michael Bortnick, Vlada, actually, Breiberg.
Right. And now she's Bortnick.
Okay. Oh, I see. And they're so married, and you're married to the right. the fourth co-founder, Julie.
Right. So we were two couples.
Okay. And you were sitting around in business school looking for a big idea.
Right. Okay. And the biggest idea at the time, this was 2006, 2007. The biggest idea at the time was Facebook. I remember Mark Zuckerberg coming into my class at the graduate GSB, and we knew that this was going to be big. Nobody had any idea how big, and at the time, actually, everybody was making fun of him. The big discussion in class was how this guy had just turned down $1 billion back when $1 billion was a whole lot of money. Now it seems like everybody can be worth $1 billion. But you know, we were all laughing at him for turning down the $1 billion offer from Yahoo. But we saw that, you know, it was just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more opportunity. And so the company we started was taking advantage of this boom in apps. And back then, when you said apps did not mean things that you played with on your phone. Apps meant Facebook apps. Apps on your phone came later. And so what we saw was an opportunity to put advertising inside these apps on the Facebook platform. And that's what Ad Nectar did.
Apps like friends for sale, or what's your pimp name, or I guess they eventually became more and more game-like, so you had Farmville, etc., but it was basic games at first. You told Nick O'Neill back in 2009 that you first were looking for what that idea was, what the form of the business would take, and you were experimenting. What kind of experiments did you run at first until you realized, aha, I think I found what our business will be?
Well, we actually were pretty cutting edge at the time. I mean, this was before lean startup techniques, or they had just started. I don't think Eric Ries had written his second book that we all know and love, The Lean Startup. He had written basically a compilation of his blog posts, and we had read that before Lean Startup. And we'd also started reading Steve Blank, and that kind of became our gospel. So we started doing very early testing. Like we would put up, back then it was incredibly easy to start a Facebook app, and you know, the vast majority of Facebook apps were total crap. And so you could basically put one up in an afternoon, and we did experiments. Like, we started putting ads inside these makeshift Facebook apps, and we see if anybody actually would want to collect a branded piece of merchandise, a piece of virtual merchandise, that is. And we showed that these early results to investors, and that's part of what helped us raise our fund.
Are some of the ads that you did inside the apps? Were they like banner ads, that kind of thing?
No, we actually, the idea was that at the time, the thesis was that apps would be, you know, super plentiful, kind of like what the app store is today on Apple or Google. We thought that would happen. This was, again, way before the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. This was when apps meant Facebook apps, and we thought there would be thousands and thousands of them, kind of like there are today with the iOS store, with the Google App Store, mm-hmm. and the Play Store. And so the idea was, look, if there's going to be tons of apps, and apps look like this, meaning they have virtual goods embedded within them, wouldn't it be great if we could put ads instead of these virtual goods? So instead of throwing sheep, instead of, you know, giving each other virtual chocolates, you would give people virtual Godiva chocolates, or, you know, whatever brand you can come up with.
And Godiva actually was one of your sponsors. I saw you talk about that case study in a few interviews. So once you had it, it was time for you.
By the way, this was a terrible business.
Why was it a terrible business?
Well, because first of all, when a young entrepreneur comes to me and they're below a certain age, and they're low on years, but they're high on the naivete, and they tell me they want to go into the ad business, I say, why? Why do you want to do ads? Because really, if they're honest with me and themselves, it's to make money. And per what we talked about before, that's a really bad reason to make your singular purpose to start a business.
Why is that a bad purpose?
If that's your primary motivator is to make a bunch of money, I don't think that's a way to live. Well, because I mean, let's look at it from the hyper rational perspective, yeah. of an expected outcome, right? Mm-hmm. So if you say, look, this is the easiest route that I can take to make a bunch of money, then you're just really bad at math, because the expected outcome of something that's extremely low probability, even if a small proportion make a lot of money, the extremely low chance of that actually happening means that you'd be much better off getting a normal job. If you're reasonably smart, you can get a normal job with a decent income. You'll have much less stress, and you'll probably have a better financial outcome than the 99% of businesses that go absolutely
or
nowhere.
Or get a job on Wall Street, et cetera. The thing
right,
is, though,
exactly.
that it feels like, I remember when I was an entrepreneur looking to make money, but it wasn't just about making money. It was about making money and having a big impact on the world. And you could only do that as an entrepreneur, I felt.
Right.
And yes, it feels like it's low probability of success, but I'm an entrepreneur because I believe in myself to a level that rationality can't really explain. And so if you have that belief in yourself and you have that need for both making money and having impact, it feels like it's a good place to go. But maybe it doesn't sustain you, because you're saying you need a little bit more passion than you can get from just pursuing money.
Yeah, you know, I'm uber for entrepreneurship. I love entrepreneurship. I think lots of people should be entrepreneurs. What I said was that making money shouldn't be your primary motivator, right? And that's why this ad test, you know, when I ask a young entrepreneur who has no experience in ad tech, in advertising, and I ask them, why do you want to do advertising? The reason is going to be money. And so that's the problem. It shouldn't be the only reason. It shouldn't be, I want to make a lot of money. That's the primary reason, because look, you know, you're not going to probably make all that much money. But if you're doing a business because fundamentally you think the product should exist, this is something that hopefully you yourself need, that you're the user of, and you believe you're the right person to bring this to market, then terrific, go for it. I'm very much for entrepreneurship. I'm just against entrepreneurs thinking that this is the fastest way to get rich.
I see. All right. And I could see that for some people, advertising would be really exciting. But for most people, it's probably just a good opportunity to make money. They see that there's a lot of money in advertising. And if you could take a piece of it, then you've got a profitable business. You weren't that excited about it. Were you excited about it in the beginning? Were you passionate about it once you discovered that you can let people give each other Godiva chocolates, virtual Godiva chocolates? Not even really. Okay.
I was excited by, and this is a lot of self-disclosure here that I'm kind good. Of opening up about. And I think it's good for people to, I wish someone had told me, or prompted me to be really honest with myself, because life is just so short. And I know we say it and we all understand how short life really is, but it's really short. Like, why waste even a day? Or you know, a startup is not something that you can just hop off of. You know, so when you start a company, by the way, you know, it's like riding a race. You know, it's like a horse race. You're going to be on that horse, mm-hmm. riding that horse until you finish the race and win it, or the horse dies.
Yeah,
you're not getting off the horse. Whereas a job, you don't like your boss, you don't like the commute, you leave, you quit. You're done. You can't do that with a startup without creating a lot of damage in your wake. So that's something we really need to consider before we start these companies. Are we doing it for the right reasons? And I think, unfortunately, people see it as just a path to financial freedom. And that's fine. It can be the byproduct of the hard work. It just shouldn't be the goal of the work.
Yeah, and there's this whole belief that if you go start a company, your time is your own, you could do whatever you want, there's no boss telling you what to do. But I'll tell you, if I just wanted to take next week off, people always think that the interviewees would be a problem. The interviewees would understand if I had to reschedule. It's all the other obligations, customers who are expecting something, and they have a right to expect something, the team that needs me to do something. Can I get away with just taking off last minute for a week? Absolutely. But would it cause damage? Oh, you bet it would.
Seriously,
it would be a problem, yeah.
Yeah, you go from entrepreneurship is about going from one boss in a normal job to right. entrepreneurship, which is having thousands of bosses.
Right. My wife works for Yahoo right now. Yes, it is a pain to take a Yahoo shuttle into work down in Silicon Valley an hour and a half each way. Really painful. But she needed to go to the hospital to see her dad the other day. She just emailed one person and said, I can't be in. Can you reschedule the meetings? And she took the day off. It's harder as an entrepreneur. All right. So I get that frustration. The idea, though, did make sense. What was first? Did you find the advertisers first, the Godiva type of companies first, or did you find the app makers who are going to incorporate your virtual goods and allow Godiva to pass these virtual Godivas out?
Well, we kind of had to do both at the same time, and there was a lot of you know, building up one site. It was a marketplace. It was essentially what Ad Networks did before then and what Ad Networks mm-hmm. still do today, just on a new platform. So building these kind of networks, building any kind of marketplace business, it has to get over this chicken or the egg problem. So mm-hmm. we were constantly making sure we had enough inventory. And then once we had enough inventory, we had enough customers to fill that inventory. It was this constant game of filling out both sides.
Do you remember
how
you got your first ones? Your first app maker to run your ads and your first advertiser to start paying for those ads?
Money. It was,
what do you
it
mean?
Was cutting checks. You know, if the check was big enough, then
you just went to the app maker and you said, look, I'm going to put some ads in here. I'm not going to wait till I get paid to pay you. Here's some money. Run my virtual goods.
Eventually we could say that, and we could say, look, when I get paid, you get paid. But in the beginning, to build trust, we had to front some of that money before we even got paid, which made it even a worse business, because then you have a cash flow problem of the ad agencies take a long time to pay. And so sometimes, you know, we'd be in a potential cash crunch situation. Never got too bad, but, you know, you open yourself up to that liability. But, you know, the idea was that technology would solve the problem eventually, that if we could get enough volume, that the transactions, the placements of these ads would happen on its own. But in the beginning, there was no technology about it. And that happens many times with startups that, you know, it's the whole man behind the curtain technique, or as Paul Graham says, do things that don't scale. You know, a lot of it in the very, very beginning was, here's the gift that we want you to place. And, you know, eventually it happened programmatically once we built the technology. But in the beginning, it was email.
How'd you get your first advertisers? You don't have an ad background.
Yeah. How we got our first advertisers. You know, we, with, well, getting your first advertiser is easy. It's getting your first paying advertiser. That's a little bit tough.
Did you get a free one at first? One to just try out? You did.
Of course. Who'd because you need case studies. I think we did Godiva was the very first one.
How do you get to Godiva? And if I wanted to reach Godiva and say, sponsor MixerG, I don't know who I would call. How'd you know?
You know, you just figure it out. So one of the real strengths of a person on the team, Julie, who is also my wife, she just figures this stuff out. I mean, this is going to sound ridiculous. She's the best Googler you have ever seen in your life. It's amazing. Like, I can Google I can look for something, and it'll take me an hour, and she'll find it in 5 minutes consistently. I don't know how she does it. She just finds stuff. And so Julie was our sales lead at the time, and she just found people. And granted, part of it is casting a wide net. I mean, part of what it takes to be a good salesperson is just your numbers, right? Making a lot of phone calls, and then you look like a genius when you can close 5 out of 100, but it's because you called 100 people that you closed 5.
Yeah, you know what? I've been showing new interviewers my CRM, because they'll tell me that they've emailed people asking for interviews and they get rejected. And I say, look at my screen. I actually have on my CRM my success rate our success rate as a team for booking guests and getting them to actually do interviews. And I think it was 67% said no or failed for one reason or another to go through the process and really clearly said no. It's not that we're waiting for a response. 67%, almost 7 out of 10 people. And most people who start out don't even email 10 people. They just think, I emailed 5 people. No one said yes. I don't want to bother anymore. And you have to get, I think, we're doing 10 and only 7, excuse me, and only 3 say yes, the new person needs to do 50.
Right. It's so true. And that's a big part of success that nobody talks about. You know, we always look for the hacks. We always look for the tricks. You know, a lot of this stuff is just who has the perseverance to make the calls, to send the emails. It's not fun work, but that's what actually gets results, is sitting behind the desk or on the phone and making those calls every day.
So Julie makes those calls. She got somebody to come in and sign up Godiva for a free trial. You put Godiva out on a couple of different apps. Was there any surprise about how the product should work, or was it as simple as, hey, you guys are doing virtual goods anyway. Here's an image that we created of a Godiva chocolate. Pass it out. Tell us how many people took it.
Yeah, I mean, it did phenomenally well. The ad experiments that we ran on these first few test campaigns were off the charts effective in terms of the metrics that advertisers are supposed to care about, right? Customer engagement and brand recall, brand preference, everything looked unbelievable. The problem was, without the so you think to yourself, okay, well, great, that, you know, it must be a great business, and that's what we all believe, and that's what that's what we were so excited about. That's why we kept pushing forward, because, you know, we ran this lean startup methodology, we did the testing, we learned from we collected the data, we measured, and now we learned from it, and okay, validated experiment, terrific, let's go. But part of the problem of being a young entrepreneur is that you sometimes lack perspective, right? We didn't know at the time the complete history of the internet, and that if you look at, you know, banner ads, when they first came out, I think the first banner ad was by AT&T, the click-through rate was what, like 80%? It was unbelievable. Today, if a banner ad gets a click-through rate of 0.02%, it's doing well. And so this is phenomenon of things that are new, are because they're novel, because they're new, they get crazy engagement rates, but then, you know, over time they decay. But funny enough, that actually wasn't our biggest problem. Mm-hmm. That was part of it.
Okay. It was
hard to replicate that initial success. That was part of the problem. But even then, we had results that were way better than our competitors, right? Putting ads on other platforms, banner ads and conventional ads. But that wasn't our biggest problem. Our biggest problem was that in the ad industry, and this might be getting a little deep into the weeds, but it was a lesson that I took away from the ad industry, is that in the display ad industry, so there's two in ad industries. When people think advertising, they think it's just one thing. It's actually really not. there are two ad industries
display
out there.
Display and direct response.
Exactly. Display and direct response. So direct response is extremely analytics driven. If you can generate more ROI for nobody, they don't even care how you, I mean, there's some parameters around how you do it, but if you do this ad versus that ad, no problem. Whatever drives more clicks, whatever drives more sales, that's what I want. They'll back up a truck of money at your door and let you do that all day long as it's a positive ROI. Display advertising, which is, you know, Coca-Cola runs a banner ad or some movie runs a banner ad or, you know, whatever it might be where the purchase does not occur by clicking that button, mm-hmm. right? Direct response is about you click a button, you check out. Brand advertising, display advertising, there's no connection, right? It's about brand affinity. It's the same reason
they run television. It's like Oreo sponsoring somebody who's really big on YouTube. They're not necessarily looking to measure how many people buy Oreos right after they see the ad. They just want people to recognize YouTube Oreos as a cool brand.
Exactly.
And that's a tremendous –
right. And that's like most television advertising, like Super Bowl commercials, that's all display advertising. Mm-hmm. They have actually – very little correlation where they can, unless you spend a ton of money, you actually don't know how effective these ads are. And that's actually what was very harmful for us and what we didn't understand going into that business, that you can only measure the impact of that kind of display advertising when you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars in ads.
So you can never go back to Godiva and say, if you would have spent $10,000 on this ad, you would have gotten $11,000 in orders. You could only show them things like, I'm looking at an old article here, you got them 1.1 million branded virtual goods that were sent, 52 million total impressions for the brand, 77,000 clicks to Godiva's fan page, and 12,000 of them became fans of the page. So that's the kind of metrics you can get, but you can't come back to them and say, we got you these sales. Godiva might be
exactly.
Okay. So actually, what's the problem with that? What's the problem?
The problem is when you say, hey, terrific, and actually Godiva kept spending with us. You know, we gave them the free campaign. They liked it. They bought it once. They bought it twice. But when we said, you know, okay, how about a bigger budget? Let's go from $50,000 to $100,000, or why not a million, right? Like, start taking money out of television advertising. Then they said, wait. But, you know, how many sales are you driving, right? How do I know what my ROI for this spend is? Before, when it was $50K, it was a fun little, you know, test budget. But now, if you want serious money, how do I measure that? And there's actually this big gap between these small tests, and brands will give you $25,000, $50,000 to test because it's novel, it's interesting, why not, it's cute. And the problem is that you can register a false positive thinking you've got this great new product with just these test budgets, where the real money comes in is, okay, well, now will you spend a million? And they say, no, we don't spend more than a million on anything but television because that's the only stuff we can measure because we spend so much money that now we can actually measure uptake.
Speaking of measurement ads, I should do my sponsorship spot for my advertiser, HostGator. And here's how they measure, HostGator.com/Mixergy. And they give you an incentive, if you're listening to me, to go to that URL. Because if you do, they will host your website, give you unlimited bandwidth. They will make sure that your site stays up. They'll make it really easy for you to install WordPress or so many other platforms so your site can run fast. All you have to do is go to HostGator.com/Mixergy, and you get that big discount. If you had a HostGator account and you were starting from scratch, just brand new out of school, and you wanted to experiment, what would you put up on that site?
I would work on something that I'm passionate about, something that can sustain me, because you know my best advice for entrepreneurial success and maybe life success is don't quit. That if you can sustain a practice of doing something for long enough, odds are you'll get pretty good with it. Not with everything, but with most things, we get better and better. Many times we can't even feel we're getting better. So, you know, I really enjoyed writing and I was passionate about writing, but I was a terrible writer. I mean, if you look at my blog and some of my first few blog posts, and I've done several hundred now over the past several years. Maybe I'm up to 1,000. I don't even know. My first few blog posts are awful. Like, they're really bad. I wrote about, you know, I think every blogger when they first start blogging does some kind of like business sports analogy. Yeah. I fell into that trap and
okay.
It was awful. But you know what? After several years of it, if I could sustain that practice of writing, you know, weekly for several years, well, then, you know, I think I'm a little better now. You know, I published this book now, and I started improving my skill. And so if you can find something that you can see yourself doing not just to make a lot of money. That's what we talked about earlier is a big no-no, but something that you could see it drives you enough to sustain you over the years, you're going to get good at it. And even if you don't make money, you're going to have that skill set. You're going to have something that you thought was worth your time.
Oh, you know what? I'm looking at your old website. It does not have the polish of this current one. I'm looking at it on archive.org. and it was powered by Blogger.
Yes. Wow, you went way, way back.
Is it now on WordPress? Research.
It's now on WordPress.
It's now on WordPress. Okay. Wow. So that's actually a really good point. You know what I would suggest if I were going to start? I would first of all put a blog up on WordPress, not Blogger, of course. And I would just use it for experimenting with ideas, experimenting with maybe you watch Andrew do interviews and you say, I'm going to go interview someone. Maybe you see that Nir is doing psychology of apps and you think, I'm going to do a blog post on it. And the cool thing about blogging is it forces you to think about it and polish it to the level that you can actually publish and have other people look at it. And it allows you to just keep experimenting and trying new ideas out to see what feels right. Where do you want to go? Maybe this will lead to a professional blogging business, which I doubt it will, or more likely it'll lead to an understanding of ideas that you care enough about that you'll turn into a product. So if you're listening to me...
No, I was just going to say, I can't recommend writing more. I mean, And there's something, you know, there's an asset that people don't realize that they have when they're new. That you know, if you're an old fart like me, and even you, no offense, you've been doing this for a while, you have a reputation, you have kind of a brand that people expect you to talk about certain things, your freedom kind of becomes limited. Like tomorrow, if I want to write about something really esoteric, if I want to write about cooking, That's weird. Like my audience is going to say, well, Nir doesn't write about cooking. Why is he writing about this? But when you're new, you can write about anything. And there's some real freedom there to just go explore whatever you're passionate about. And here's the secret weapon of writing is that people think that you should only write when you have a good idea. That is not why I write. I write when I want to know an answer that I don't yet know the answer of.
Yes.
It's amazing how I feel like I learn when I write.
Right. And that also solves another problem where people feel they can't publish something until they know it well enough to be an authority on it. Who am I to write a post on psychology of mobile app usage? Who you are is someone who's going to go out in the world, research it a little bit, and you can publish it on your site. You can go and do an interview with someone who you want to learn from and publish it on your site. You don't have to know it all. You can learn a little bit of it and publish it. All right, I should close this out by saying go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. You'll get 30% off. You'll be up and running with your blog within minutes. And if you want to grow it, it'll continue to grow with you. If you want to scale it, it will scale with you. If you get a lot of traffic, they will help keep you up. And if they don't, they have a support number that you can call. Really, get started on it and show me what you've built. Do it within a week of publishing it and come back to the comments and let me see what you've built. Hostgator.com/Mixergy. I'm grateful to them for sponsoring. So, Nir, you were saying that was the problem. You were just talking about the duality of advertising. There is the people who just want brand recognition, and those are harder to get. And the people who are looking for a clear ROI, they're easier to get, but it's harder to show an ROI with your product. Do you feel if you were more excited about the business that you would have found a way to give them the ROI that they were looking for, and that maybe the lack of passion is what kept you from pursuing that ROI?
I think it wasn't that, you know, it's hard to say I lacked passion because I believed in the opportunity. But I think I was too focused on the outcome, right? And so the problem with focusing on the outcome is that when things get rocky and the outcome becomes uncertain, then it's really hard to recover. Whereas if you learn to enjoy the process, the way I run what I do today is making sure that the practice is what's important, right? It's my 2 hours of writing every day. It's the practice that, as I was saying before, if you do long enough, if you can sustain, you'll find the answer. And so if the end goal wasn't, oh, this better IPO and have a big sale so we can make money, if that wasn't the end goal, if the end goal was, you know, this is going to make the world a better place, and even if we don't have a good successful financial outcome, it was worthy of my time because the world is going to be better for it no matter what, then that sustains you, right?
That's
what keeps you going so that you don't kind of give up at some point and say, well, it doesn't look like we're going to have a good outcome. Move on.
You did raise money for it. I guess investors were excited about the numbers you were showing them, right? And this was a growing field at the time. People believed that Facebook was going to be a platform the way Microsoft's Windows was a platform.
Right.
right? And so you raise money. Did that change the pressure?
Yes, absolutely. What started out as a fun project between friends, you know, there was the joy. Initially, what sustains a lot of entrepreneurs, and when I see great entrepreneurs, they always have this kind of killer instinct of, you know, I want this to exist so I can show them, right? So it's the game of I'm going to make this work to prove something. And frankly, that's not me. I wish it was. And it took me a long time to realize that's not me. But that kind of that spirit of, oh, I'm gonna show you I can do this for the sake of doing it was not enough to carry me. I didn't really have that much to prove, right? Like I didn't come from a broken home and have something that I want to show the world. You know, I was pretty fortunate, and so I didn't have that to carry the day. What carries me now that I found something that I'm really passionate about is the work itself, right? Is the process of what I think is actually important work of bringing the message of what I'm doing to the broader audience. But when you do take money, that little fun little experiment that you're playing on, suddenly, you know, we talked about how there's this myth that when you're an entrepreneur, you don't have bosses. You know, if you want to see a tough boss, take $5 million from somebody and see how that
is that how much you took?
Changes. Yeah.
You took it from Battery. Who else?
Kleiner Perkins, Mike Maples, and a few angel investors.
Wow. When you sold, did they get their money back?
They got part of their money back. Unfortunately, we couldn't give them all their money back.
So how did you feel about that? That to me, I can't remember the entrepreneur who I interviewed, Mark Jeffries, that's who it was, couldn't return money back to his investor. He told him, I think he even cried about it because he couldn't do it. And he got this great letter back from his investor saying, you tried, you did everything you could, and I'm just really proud to know you because of that. But it was reassuring to him because it was so devastating to not be able to return the money back. How did that feel to you?
Well, it wasn't good. Frankly, you know, we got an okay outcome, but not. It was a soft landing. It was a soft landing for Adnector. It was we got some money, but not a ton. You know, these things have all kinds of clauses written into the agreements that some people get more than others. But it sucks. It's not fun when you don't have a big outcome. On the other hand, I didn't cry for my investors.
They weren't the kind of people you would cry for. Kleiner Perkins.
No.
Okay.
They were good. Most.
No, I mean
of them.
It's not like they're gonna go. It's not like an individual who just pulled money out of his bank account and gave it to you. It's a venture capital firm that does this for a living. They're not going to avoid dinner tonight because of this.
Exactly. And look, now that I'm an angel investor and I've put in money into other companies, I've had some companies that have liquidated for one reason or another. Some of them have been total zeros, and what I tell the entrepreneurs and that, you know, when we sit down for dinner and they're kind of saying, look, you know, it's not going as well as I thought, but you know, we're going to pull it out. It's going to come. I say, look, you know, your most valuable asset right now is your time. And so don't waste your time right now trying to make your investors whole necessarily. If you think that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, that's fantastic. Go for it, you know, push forward. And, you know, here's even more money if you think you can make it happen. But if the only reason is, you know, oh, I'm going to pay back my investors, it's laudable, but it's that's not why professional investors get into the business. They want to save their time. They want you to save your time so that you can go to the next thing that hopefully will be successful.
Why wasn't it successful? Was it because what you said earlier, you couldn't convince brand advertisers to buy these ads and you couldn't convert into a direct response business?
Well, there was that, but that so a lot of things have to go right in a business. Let's be honest. And there was a lot I didn't know back then that I now know. Right? There's a lot of work that I've done along the way. This was a long time ago. This was 2007 when we started that company. So it's been a long time since then. There's a lot of things I didn't know, and part of it was how many things, you know, have to go right. And we actually pivoted into other businesses. That's why, you know, when I talked about the Godiva example, that's why that specific product didn't work, but we pivoted into other products.
What else? I couldn't find it. I Googled so right? much.
So we did all kinds of other, still apps, but it wasn't just about virtual goods. We started just about virtual goods. Then we started all kinds of ad optimization within apps. And then something terrible happened. Mm-hmm. And that thing, that terrible thing that happened kind of out of nowhere is our central thesis. When we went and raised money from Kleiner Perkins, we said, look, if you believe that the app universe is going to have thousands of app makers right? Kind of like our, we said, kind of like there's, you know, countless web pages out there. If you believe, which what we believed, that there would be thousands and thousands of app makers out there, then there should be a network to aggregate these apps and sell ads on them. And that's the case today with mobile apps. There's lots of businesses kind of similar to AdNectar that do what we tried to do on mobile apps. Mm-hmm. But on Facebook, what happened in the course of 3 months is that when Facebook shut down the viral spigot, they didn't let apps get this kind of viral growth that they were experiencing. The app universe on Facebook went from thousands of different companies to about three in the course of 90 days. When Facebook made that huge change.
They decimated the whole business.
They decimated. And this is where Nick O'Neill and a lot of my friends in that industry really, you know, upended that entire industry in the span of a matter of days, which taught me a very powerful lesson, which I take with me into my professional life, is that when you build a product on someone else's platform, you have a lot more risk than you may appreciate. And we see this all the time, right? Yesterday or 2 days ago, Facebook announced that it's basically copying several of the apps, including Flipboard, and saying, nope, we're going to do that ourselves. Thanks
Apple
very much.
Did, even though right. You built on our, they're integrating Apple did, other people's saying. Apps into their platform, right? Or did you mean Facebook?
I'm sorry, Apple. Right. Yep. Not Facebook. Sorry. So Apple just announced that they're basically building what looks like Flipboard for themselves, and it's going to be part of the operating system on iOS. That happens.
Yeah. Yeah, they're watching to see what are the most popular apps on their platform. Right. They did the same thing for music, or they're trying to.
Right, exactly.
It's so funny going back to the older stuff where you say, oh, we're going to work on lots of platforms, because you did in the early days have a response to that. You said, we're also on MySpace, and then you gave this other one, like Mies or something, and I never heard of it. But
LiveJournal.
LiveJournal, for sure. That was a big announcement.
Right. Facebook was not the first platform. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't for a long time that even people thought it would be the dominant social network that it is today. I mean, there was real competitors from people we thought at the time. This was when, you know, MySpace for a long time was way bigger than Facebook.
And Ning had so much more to offer individuals created networks on there.
Started by Mark Andreessen, right? Andreessen, the legend, started Ning.
Yeah, and they were going to, if you pull your network onto Ning, you could get the email addresses of people in your network. So they gave you a bigger incentive to create your network there, and still we all build our network on Facebook. So then how did you find an exit? How did you find lockers and work out a way to sell your business?
Right. Well, you know, we looked for acquirers at one point. You know, we knew that we had a technology that we thought was valuable, that we had several patents on. We made the best of that technology. We had great people. We did partial outbound, partial inbound. You know, you do what's called running a process, and you kind of test the waters. And
What is the process? How do you figure out? You start making calls to people saying, hey, we're thinking. You can't call them up and say, hey, I'm thinking of selling.
Right.
What's your way of
saying? It's typically done through investors. That Lockers was a portfolio company of Kleiner Perkins.
Okay.
And that's how that introduction was made. But there were other parties that were interested. We were in talks with several names out there.
I see. So your investors initiated, and they start saying, who else in our portfolio should be acquiring this business? I see. And then I guess once you get them going, you can start having conversations with other people saying, look, my investors are already talking to this other company, but I like you. Should we talk a little bit about a partnership?
Right, you meet very quickly with these interested parties. I mean, the investors make the intro, but then, you know, it's not much more than an email.
I see. Wow. How did it feel to have the sale go through? Do you remember the day?
Yeah, I don't remember the day. You know, it doesn't really happen on a day. It happens kind of in small bits and pieces. But I remember the day when we made the decision that it would be better to save the time and money we had and take the deal. And it's bittersweet. At the time, I didn't know what was next. I mean, had I known how much satisfaction I would find in what I'm doing now, I wouldn't have been so bummed. But at the end of the day, I was really tired and unhealthy too. I remember I gained in those 3 years that we were in that industry, I gained about 15, 20 pounds, I think. And, I was not taking very good care of myself. I put everything into that business. I got shingles at one point running that company, which is a disease that you're not supposed to get as a a young 30-something, and I went to my doctor, and you know, I said, "Yeah, you've got shingles," and the only other people I see with shingles are people who are in their 80s who have, you know, autoimmune disorders. You know, a guy in his 30s is not supposed to get this kind of stress-related problem.
I've heard a few people, a few entrepreneurs who got shingles. It is stress-related when you get it at that age. The other thing that I'm realizing people get is panic attacks. Do you ever have panic attacks?
I never had panic attacks. I mean, I had sleepless nights, but I don't remember
what happened for you. Sleepless nights. I've had those.
Yeah. No, you know, when you have so many different things running around your head, that can keep you up at night. And for a few years, I was not sleeping well.
One of my things was, what are people going to say who thought that I was invincible, who I tried to convince that I was invincible, when they see that this failed? They're going to laugh at it. It's going to be really too embarrassing. Do you remember one of yours?
Right. Well, I thought, you know, I'd never be able to work again.
Ah.
That if an investor puts money into you and you can't, you know, deliver on the promise of what you show them in that slide that says, here's our expected revenue, you know, to me, it felt like a lie. It felt like I was, I told you one thing and here I delivered something else. And if we had good reasons and all that, that was fine. There was a way to rationalize it. But fundamentally, I felt bad that we couldn't deliver on those results. That would keep me up at night. And of course, there's always the challenge of doing more. One of the benefits of having a 9-to-5 is that you clock out and you're kind of done. Whereas when you run a business, there's always more to do. There's never a time when you say, "Oh, done. You know, I can sleep well."
I remember one time thinking, "This is my first company. This is going to go down to zero, and I'm burning out, and I can't take a break, because if it goes down to zero, it means I have no money, which means I have to work right away for someone else and prove myself to them instead of taking a break, just when you can't handle it anymore." You know, this is why I do say entrepreneurs are heroes. I got into a disagreement with one of my past guests about it, who said entrepreneurs aren't heroes. They're, I don't know who he thinks are heroes, firefighters and police officers and so on. I'd say I accept it. A firefighter who goes into a burning building is absolutely a hero. But an entrepreneur who can take on a job that's safe and secure and can provide for his family, but instead says, "I'm going to take a big risk because I believe that something should exist in the world," and gives jobs and then puts up with shingles and sleepless nights and sometimes actually, frankly, real financial impact to their families, that's a hero in my book, especially when you see the upside of all this, especially when you see the kinds of people you could potentially help.
Yeah. And it's I think one of the things that I internalized from the business was that it's a reflection on my intellect, on my worth, if the business succeeds or fails. And I think that's a gigantic mistake. And I think it's easy to do. And unfortunately, you know, when we judge people, we want to see that if that they have a track record of success. But you know, a lot of times these track records, there's an element of luck to all this stuff. There's an element of trying and trying again. That if you can consistently keep doing this practice of starting businesses, eventually you're going to get a hit. But of course, we only talk about the hits, right? We only talk about the successes. Whereas I thought, you know, if you have one a suboptimal outcome, then that says you're not smart enough, you're not good enough, and that's something I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with. And of course, nothing can be further from the truth. I mean, look, Mark Zuckerberg and the Google guys, they're all smart guys, but you know what? There's a lot of people in Silicon Valley that are just as smart as them. Not that they're not smart, but you know, the most successful has very little correlation with the most smart. In fact, I think there's a lot of people who are too smart for entrepreneurship because they can't make decisions.
So then what do we do? Does it mean then that things are just too random and too based on luck for us to try? Or
no, I think it's about being humble and realizing that that being smart are the table stakes. That everybody around here is smart. That's not what it takes. What it takes is right place and the right time and doing the right actions to see success. But it's not 100% in your control.
Your first business, Sunshine Business Development, was that a hit?
That was good. I mean, for us, we didn't raise. It was a very different scenario because we had no venture capital in that business. Frankly, I didn't even know what venture capital was. I started that company after I used to be a consultant at Boston Consulting Group, and I started that business back when nobody was doing solar. And the best way to describe what we did was kind of like what SolarCity does today. And of course, SolarCity is a publicly traded company now. So we did something very similar to what SolarCity does today, but this was back in 2003. So this was a long time ago when the only people inside the solar industry were, you know, leftovers from the Carter administration. And
What does it mean that you did that? Here's what you say on your LinkedIn profile. You co-founded and managed a renewable energy distribution, wholesale, and retail business. Does that mean that you sold solar panels to for people to put on their homes and you financed it for them so they don't have to put it all up front?
We, at the time, there wasn't such a thing. Now you can purchase the energy as opposed to buying the entire solar system. That that didn't exist back then. So we had to like go through the manual work of connecting them with financers and home equity loans and all that stuff.
And you would go door to door. Actually, no, it wasn't door to door. How did you get your clients there?
So, you know, at the time, we used this amazing thing called the internet, which at the time nobody was using, believe it or not. I mean, the way solar, it sounds ridiculous today because solar is such a big industry today, but it was nothing. It was puny back then. It was a fraction of how big it is today. And people weren't using the kind of technologies that we take for granted. Like one thing we did, which is now common practice, but as far as I know, I think we were the first people to do it back in 2003, is that we use satellite imagery. Google didn't even have this data yet. We had to go to a third party that collected aerial imagery of people's homes, and we would send them letters that says, your home is solar qualified, because, you know, not every home can have solar. You don't have enough room. It's not facing the right direction. And so we did that, and it was a very scalable way to find new customers.
Oh, that's fantastic. What else did you do to get customers?
So that was the most innovative thing we did. There was a lot of things that we did that are just standard practice, going to home shows and, you know, mailers and sometimes door to door.
I am. So one of the things that I do when I Google people is I do a search for their company name, and then most people don't know it, but there's this little drop down menu underneath the search bar on Google that says more. And if you select, oh no, not more. Where is that? Let me clear it so I can see it. It's underneath, it says search tools, and you click on that, and then you can limit your search to a certain time. So I'm going to limit my search to 2005, everything up until 2005, and I type in Sunshine Business Development, LLC. Nothing comes up.
Yeah.
It was, did you guys have a website at the time?
We did. I think the company we sold to still has it. If you do Solar Long Island or Sunshine Long Island. That's where the business was based. I'm sure their site is still up.
You sold it to private investors?
Right.
What kind of an exit did you get from that?
A nice one.
That's the one that qualifies you to be an angel investor.
Right.
So let me ask you this. When AdNectar wasn't doing well, was that any reassurance? There's this belief that if you have a hit, you should have nothing to worry about because you're going to eat, you're going to be able to provide for your family, you're going to be okay.
Right.
Did it? Did it give you that okay feel? Or it didn't actually, because you're still up nights. Why didn't it give you the okay feeling? Why couldn't you just go to sleep saying, hey, you know what? Okay. I got money in the bank. I have a business that I started that already succeeded. Any investor who doesn't believe that this last business succeeded can go talk to the investors who bought it. Anyone who thinks I'm going to be hungry or any – I could provide. Why isn't that enough? Because it's not.
Well, to be clear, I would not have started AdNectar if I didn't have the previous exit from Sunshine. I just don't have that kind of guts, to be honest. I'm not that brave. And it's because I knew that I had a bit of a nest egg that I could take that chance. Why was it still keeping me up at night?
Because, yeah.
Well, that's just one factor. I mean, there's a lot of things that were on my mind. One of them, and frankly, I don't know how I could have handled it. I know I wouldn't have done it if I was also thinking, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to pay rent. Maybe some entrepreneurs can handle that kind of stress. I certainly couldn't. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. Like when somebody comes to me and says, I have a great idea for a business, I say, great, do you have a day job first so that you can do some validation? You know, let's get some to a point where you can either raise money or make some income on this business before you quit your day job. Because, I mean, I think it puts so much stress on you that you can't even, at one point, you can't even think creatively because all you can think about is
nobody
bills
talks
being
about
due.
That if you want it bad enough, if you burn the boats, right? Burning the boats is a big statement. Goes back to Cortez, I guess, who landed on a beach, burned his boat so his soldiers couldn't go and escape. And so they had no other option but to win. And this belief that if you have no other option but to win, then you'll have to win, doesn't take into account that there's some point where the pressure on you is so big, you can't think of anything else. You can't, as you said, be creative, even if you could show up every day.
Entrepreneurship is full of platitudes that are not based in any kind of research that I've seen. And I think that's one of them. Yeah. You know, burning your ships does work for some people in some circumstances. I think in other circumstances, it makes people throw up on the shore.
Yeah, at some point, it's too much. Exactly. Right. It's debilitating. And you know what? And there's another thing that I don't believe people understand, which is it's not just about, like, can you survive? Can you feed yourself? At some point, it becomes about, I made a promise to someone. Maybe I made a promise to a client. I've got to live up to it. I know, right, for me with Mixergy, I'm not going to die. My son, Shep, is going to be able to eat even if Mixergy fails completely. But if it fails, there's this belief that I have that it's a letdown for him. There's this issue that I have with a letdown for people who signed up for Mixergy and are expecting some kind of result in their lives. It's all that stuff.
Right. It's your employees. There's more to it. And of course, when you take investment and you make a promise to those people who put money in your company or people who put their lives into your company, they've been working with you for years. That I mean, that's what kept me up at night was first and foremost my employees, then my investors, everybody else.
We've talked a little bit about these two companies. How do you feel having talked about it? I don't see you talk about them much. Do you feel exposed? Do you feel like we wasted time?
No, you know, I like talking about stuff that I'm uncomfortable discussing because it makes me question why I'm uncomfortable in the first place. And I know exactly why I'm uncomfortable about this because we judge people based on their successes. But I know better that, you know, being in the entrepreneurship game, I know that there's a lot of factors outside someone's control that to judge them based on, you know, the success of one venture or another, good or bad, is not enough. Just because you have a great outcome doesn't mean you're a genius. And if you didn't have the best outcome, that doesn't mean you're a failure and you're, you know, inferior somehow.
If Ad Nectar had been a huge success, would you have put that in your bio in your book? Would you have put the name, even if it wasn't a Google level, if it was just like a $10 million exit?
Probably not.
Even
because
not.
Even a $10 million exit is not anything to write home about. A $10 million exit is a soft landing too. If you raise $5 million,
right,
then the investors are expecting a 10x return.
See, I have a disagreement with you on this. I believe what you did is highly relevant because of the kinds of companies that you're talking to. I believe that including the name is important because of the other authors in the space who have no experience and pretend they do. How many people who do I just want to name the person? What do you think? Is it okay for me to name someone who's acting like a CEO of a successful company, even if he's not? Would you feel
now
comfortable
I'm just
with
curious.
It? Sorry?
Now I'm just curious. Now I'm curious to know who you're going to say.
Here's my belief based on my research. I was at a conference and I saw someone who was introduced as a founder of Evite. Mm-hmm. And he founded Speak. And I said, I should interview him. And I went and I did research on the guy. And I saw, sure enough, there was a period there where he just announced himself as a founder of Evite, or other people had, at least based on my research. Mm-hmm. He wasn't a founder of Evite. I went back and, again, doing the search that I just talked to you about Google, I went back and I did a search and he was not mentioned at all in any Evite articles from back in the day when Evite was starting, when Evite was big, when Evite was growing. None of that. Mm. What he was a guy who at some point was about to start a business, in my opinion, I don't know for sure, who said, if I am a founder of Evite, then I get more credibility, and as a result, more people will care, and so I will call myself a founder of Evite. He might not have even called himself exactly a founder of Evite. Maybe he said I was on the founding team of. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I did a lot of research, and I saw he just wasn't, at least based on my research. Mm-hmm. I don't want to indict the guy here. I think that I'm remembering to the best of my ability here, but I will say that apart from him, this happens all the time. Someone will, especially for authors, they will have been a part of some company. They will take the credit for having launched and built and succeeded with the company, and then they come up with a book that has nothing in it. And when I first researched you, I said, who is this guy? And I said, I don't see any of it. But then I saw all the other credibility indicators that made me say, all right, this guy's got something. But no one's going to do the kind of research I did. I believe that it's important for you to talk about it and say, here's what I did. Here's the name of the company. Here's what worked for it, and here's what didn't work. It adds a lot of credibility in a world where people don't earn it.
It could be, too, that I think a lot of us around here feel this imposter syndrome, right? That, like, at any moment, we're going to be discovered. And that's something as a concept I learned in business school. And it's something that, you know, once I heard, I was like, oh my God, I kind of have done that for a long time. And here I am at Stanford Business School, which I thought, man, if I only get into Stanford Business School, then I'll have the stamp that says right. that I'm smart enough, right? And if I only start a business that makes that gets a public offering, then I'll prove that I have a stamp that says I'm smart enough. And if I only write a book that becomes a Wall Street bestseller, then I'll have the stamp that says I'll be good enough.
And it's still not there. And there's no nothing.
And as much as I say this to you, and I know it's silly, and I know we shouldn't feel this way. I appreciate that you push me to articulate it again, because it's a message that I constantly need to remind myself that it's a universal syndrome, I think, for people who are trying to achieve something.
I'm glad that you feel comfortable having done it at the end of the interview, especially since I've gotten to know you off the interviews too. You know, the reason I'm hesitating right now is I'm wondering, well, do I feel good about the way that I talked about the founder of Speak or not? Because there's no way I'm deleting it or editing it out. I feel so-so about it, and I'll tell you why I feel so-so about it. I want to talk about it publicly because I think it's important to bring the audience into it. I believe that going back and doing research for my interview with Jackie Martling, one of the guys from the Howard Stern Show, opened my eyes to how honest they used to be on the Howard Stern Show, how open they used to be, brutally so. And I said, you, Andrew, are pulling your punches with Mixergy. You still have feelings that you're not expressing. You still have truths that you're not saying because you're worried that if you speak out this truth that someone's going to then say something about you or pull some truth out about you. Or you, Andrew, are afraid of saying what you know because you're worried that this is a small community and someone's going to come back and punish you for it. And so when it came to talking about this guy from Speak, I said, do I want to say what I know publicly or not? And I said, well, if you're really going to learn from the research that you did and from this self-analysis where you want to be more truthful, more open, then you have to talk about it. And so in that sense, I'm a little bit proud of it. In the other sense, I also feel a little bit vulnerable because of all the things that I just said. And yeah. On top of all that, if you're going to speak out, you should just speak out. You shouldn't do this like hemming and hawing, right? You should just say, here's what I've researched, here's what I found, here's what I've noticed is a bigger trend that we should all be aware of. But I'm going through this transition where I'm
yourself,
trying
aren't
to do
you? Go ahead. You're going through a transition, you said?
Yeah, that's it. I'm going through a transition where I always was trying to be as open as possible on Mixergy, but I realize that there's still places where I'm not open. I always was trying to be more conversational on Mixergy, but I realize that there's a formality to the intro, which is why I interrupt my intros now and I get into more of the conversation. I want this to be a better and better conversation. I do see the other interviews out there and I feel like they bring no research, no background, no nothing. But at the same time, if I'm going to say I'm better than them because I do all this research and I do all this preparation, I have to also say, am I better than myself yesterday? Am I better than my past interviews? And I have to admit that I'm not pushing myself enough. And I have to say, where else is there for me to go? What else can I do? And
is it entertaining for you? I mean, when you don't push yourself, when you don't ask these uncomfortable questions, is it fun or is it boring? Would you want to listen?
You know, my most fun conversations are the ones that I have one-on-one apart from Mixergy. I don't know how to bring that here, where I will get together with an entrepreneur and we'll talk about things like marriage problems or talk about panic attacks or talk about the first time we had sex or talk about all these things that don't seem directly related to business, but they so are. They're the core of why we bond. They're the core of what conversations are really like. And then they come back to business because when you come to business directly, often you come at it with this expectation of how you're supposed to talk about business. You come at it with this with this practice because you practice pitching to investors and pitching to your employees. And so there's this practice about it. When you come at it from, let's talk about something really open about which we don't usually talk, like our marriage issues, it creates an environment to be more honest and be more real and be more in the moment that then allows us to have more real conversations about work. And that's a challenge because if I push people to talk about that stuff on camera, it's a very scary thing for them to talk about. And they then put up walls that I don't know how to get around. And at the same time, I know that we're in an environment that is very sexist. I've hired people to help me find guests who, when I say we need more women, they'll say, well, will the audience respect you more if you have more women? We should, and they intentionally fight me about it, or secretly fight me on getting more women on interviews. And I realize that if it's uncomfortable for women in this environment, if it's uncomfortable for people to be more, because we're spilling out the sex stuff too much, then I, even though I'm coming from a good place with it, I don't think that's that is an easy thing to bring up in interviews. Anyway, this is a really long, very train of thought way of answering, which I'm kind of proud of. Because I know my real audience, my real fans will get this and help me shape it. But the short answer is yes, I do enjoy these interviews. And if I don't, I just throw a curveball that will make it more interesting for me. But I don't enjoy them as much as my private one-on-one conversations. And I don't know how to get to that.
Have you ever experimented with other mediums? Like I've done some research on embodied cognition and how things in our environment change our decision making pretty profoundly.
Like what?
Like if you hold a cup of coffee and you have a warm hand from holding that cup of coffee, and then you shake someone else's hands, they perceive you to be more friendly. Or wait, do they perceive you? No, I think you perceive them. Sorry. You perceive them to be more friendly. Whereas if you're holding a cold cup of coffee, you perceive them to be less friendly. Like, it has nothing to do with the person. It's all about this physical environment. Yeah. And I wonder if maybe and this is just brainstorming here, what do I know? But I wonder if the fact that, like, here I see you on this video with Skype in the corner, I feel like I'm being interviewed on 60 Minutes or something, and I want to be a little bit more guarded. Now, you know, it's you, and we have a relationship outside of these interviews as well, and I try and be as honest as possible about everything that we discuss. But with I kind of feel like I'm on stage and I need to tell you what I think the audience wants to hear. But what you really want to hear is what I really think. And I wonder if you tried with, like, you know, when I do podcasts today, everybody wants to do Skype. But I wonder if we went back to the phone and it became just like an intimate conversation over the telephone, if people would be more willing to share with you.
Or even you suggested just coming in here and recording in person. And I said no, because it's so much work to edit it and so much work to set up the mics. But maybe that's an area where I should be considering pushing it. There should be a way for me to do it, even if it's after hours when there's nobody walking around, and just have a couple of mics. I could hire someone to set that up. You know what? I hadn't thought of it. I thought, how do I change the substance? And you're making me think, how do I change the
environment,
the framework, or the environment of it?
Right. Like that. What's that Jerry Seinfeld show that he's doing now, where he talks to comedians?
Comedians in cars with coffee or something. Yes.
Right. I wonder if there's something there about the cues that we get from our environment that tells us how we should and should not behave.
That's a good point. All right. You've given me something to think about.
just an idea. What do I know?
No, you do know a lot. Actually, one of the reasons why I like reading your work is that you have this research and this different approach to life that you bring into your blog posts. The other thing that I like about reading your work, even outside of your blog, and your blog is Near and Far, NIRANDFAR, Near and Far, near spelled like your name, NIR. You and your wife got open about something like how you were fondling your technology too much in bed, and you said, we're going to try to take some steps away from technology. And I like your openness. I met your wife once at a dinner, and I've gotten to know your relationship offline. I like it. But I like how open you are about things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Like, I read when I first started blogging, I read this piece about how to write great stuff, how to be a productive author, and one of the things that I always remember about it was that she had this beautiful line in the essay about if you don't find what you're writing interesting, there is no way in hell the reader is going to find it interesting, right? And so that's what I want to read about. Like, I would want to know, how do people have a healthy sex life when they're constantly checking their devices all night, right? Like, that's interesting to me, because that's a problem that
I think nobody cares about that stuff. I mean, when you talk about sex life intellectually, I think, all right, sex always sells, let's do it. But when you talk about social things intellectually, I think nobody cares to read about them. But then I remember reading the Boron Letters by Gary Halbert, because so many of my guests talked about it. And he's a copywriter who happens to be in jail, and I couldn't figure out why he was in jail, but he was writing letters to his son that were just so fascinating. And one of the things that was interesting is he would start the letter saying, I'm sitting cross-legged in my cell today writing to you on this notepad. The guy next door in the cell next door is making noise, and I'm trying to tune him out so I can focus on you. onward. Let's talk about my lesson for you for today. And that little touch of where he is, intellectually you'd think he's wasting my time with information and knowledge I can't use. How am I going to process or file away or build better or write better copy because I know he's sitting in his jail cell? But still, it adds color and it brings me into the moment and it makes it more interesting. And I think that's what your writing has. All right, we have gone way over here. I'm going to – maybe I shouldn't say way over. We've gone over. I'm going to tell people that if they want to follow up with you, first of all, they should get your book. But frankly, if they're in the Mixergy audience, they've already bought your book. I'm looking on your website. Matt Mullenweg has read your work. Andrew Chen, Dave McClure, these guys gave you testimonials. All you need is them. You don't even need Andrew Warner to say, go get the book. You get those guys, and people should either have the book or they should get out of the tech industry. Or maybe they're not readers. You know, if they're not readers, I get it. But but if they are, I feel like people in our space have read the book. So I should just...
If you're illiterate, don't buy the book. It won't do you much good.
Right. If you're illiterate, get the audiobook. or nirandfar.com. I'm glad that you came here and talked about it. I didn't realize until minutes before the interview that you had a whole other agenda, that you wanted to talk about distraction. And I'd like us to do something about distraction. You taught the concepts from Hooked in Mixergy Masterclass. I think people are going to freaking love that. And they're going to be able to learn how to create products that hook people in that are almost addictive. But as much as I like both those topics, I'm really glad that I got to see your story here. And I think our audience agrees. If you guys agree or disagree, please let me know. And of course, if you like this interview, please go into your favorite podcast app and subscribe to Mixergy so you can get every single one of my interviews directly in whatever your favorite device is. And if you love this interview, please go and leave me a rating on iTunes. Just go to mixergy.com/podcast and give a review. Thank you, Nir, for doing this.
Thank you. It was fun.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, everyone.